This was a week that I will not soon forget. This was a week where a lot of things happened. This was a week where I paid attention to the news more than I have previously, and I was rewarded for that attention. And as a result, a 120-minute episode turned into a 4-hour episode. And there is so much information, and so much interview, and so many good things, and so many responses to good things, that I would be remiss to cut it away and to turn it into just one episode, one 100-minute episode, one 80-minute episode even. So we've decided to split this week into two episodes, and here comes the first episode, and later this week comes the second episode. So I hope you enjoy it. This is a really good interview where we talk about the Pro-Truth Pledge and a bunch of other things, and then once you've listened to the episode and you've digested all of that information, then we follow up with a discussion of what the Pro-Truth Pledge actually means and my response to it, and then a discussion of all the stupid political things that were... But it works. It totally works. So stick with us. Here comes the show. Well, it's Sunday. And now I'm doing my show instead of somebody else's show.
Yeah. They're all your show.
No, they're not.
Okay.
We had a really fun time yesterday with Atheist Nomad's 200th episode
200th
celebration.
200th show.
That's awesome.
And I'm glad nobody asked me how many shows we've done because I don't actually know. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-Skeptic, 844-753-7842. My name continues to be Sam, and this is my show. I don't think I've actually said the full name of the show in some time. And it's a show about atheism, skepticism, the separation of the church and state, and politics when I feel like it. Joining me today, for the first time in a while, because he's been a world traveler.
I have.
Ron John, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Yes, I have been traveling to India twice and Vegas once.
Oh.
I was there for a day, and like I won $6.
Yeah, that's generally how I do in Vegas. I mean, I do a little bit of gambling when I'm in Vegas, but that's because my dad was pleasant enough to inform me that if you go to Vegas and you keep gambling, they keep bringing you booze for free.
This is true.
So
yes,
and,
they do
and,
do that.
And so yeah. He looked over what had the best odds of any game in gambling,
and then found a comfy chair and went to town.
Yeah, he found video blackjack, because then you don't have to socialize. You
right.
can just sit there and with your friend and pretend to play, and you have to play as slow as possible, but not so slow that security comes and kicks you out.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so I won $6 gambling, but I did also have sushi in a landlocked city. So gambling has different definitions.
Yeah, that's a different different style of gambling. And Becky, how are you?
I'm, well, a little under the weather, a little bit more encolded for some reason.
What's wrong with under the weather? Have you seen the weather out there? It's fantastic today.
It is, and somehow I still end up under it. I survived the entire school year as a school teacher without getting significantly sick, and then boom, spring hits, and suddenly your nasal cavities are filled.
Yeah, it's beautiful here in Tacoma. Not much more to say about it. I was about to tell the...
We were driving through a cottonwood tree orgy on the way here. Seriously, the pollen is like crazy. It's like driving through a snowstorm.
Oh, is it cottonwood time?
It is cottonwood time.
That might be why I had to take...
18 allergy pills.
18 allergy pills this morning.
Yeah.
But there's good news in the Pacific Northwest. Oregon Governor Kate Brown signed into law a bill that allows for secular celebrants to officiate weddings in the state. The bill, sponsored by Senator Hayward and Representative Greenlick in response to lobbying efforts by the Center for Inquiry and the Secular Coalition for Oregon, a chapter of the Secular Coalition for America. Previously, only religious officials or certain government employees could solemnize marriages. Representative Greenlick had tried in 2015 to pass a similar bill, which failed over debate about what constituted a secular organization. The new law defines it as an organization that occupies a place in the lives of the organization's members, parallel to that filled by a church or a particular religious authority.
I've never been so excited to see the word parallel. That's exactly what it should be.
Yeah.
It's dead on.
I can hear in my head, because I have this, I have this, you know, idea of what people who listen to the show are like, that there's going to be a section of them who are saying, these organizations are nothing like the church.
Mm-hmm.
But there are parallels.
Right.
Parallel is a good word.
Yes. They do similar things for people, but by different means.
Right.
And that's exactly what it is.
I think this is really cool because I first heard about this sort of catch-22 for secular individuals in Oregon when we went down to Vancouver County Council, or the city, no, what is it, Clark County in Vancouver, that was trying to put up In God We Trust, which ended up succeeding.
Yeah.
And we ended up speaking with some of the folks from CFI Portland from across the river.
I'm blanking on the name.
That would be
Danny and Sylvia at the time.
It would be Brian Harvey.
Brian Harvey.
And he was working on this, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago, because the catch-22 that secular people found themselves in was you can either, you know, everybody in Oregon has to pay for their marriage license, right? But then you can go to a religious individual, a religious leader, to solemnize your marriage. And there's really, that's up to the pastor or the rabbi or the imam for if they want to charge you. But if you're a secular individual and you want to go to, say, certain justices of the peace or other people that can officiate marriages from the government side of things, there's a mandatory fee, which essentially puts a marriage tax on someone to be married in a non-religious way. And having this equalize things brings secular individuals into you know, even footing with religious individuals. You know, if a priest wants to charge $400 to solemnize your wedding, great, that's fine, that's up to the priest. But he could also say, through my vocation, I feel that solemnizing marriages is something that has no monetary value, and so I choose to charge you nothing. Just as us now, a secular officiant could do.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really good news, and I'm really glad for the people of Oregon, and in all sorts of ways. And looking at 3 years ago or 2 years ago, why this was an issue, there were people from the secular community, from the atheist community and humanist communities that were holding out on getting married until two things happen. One, marriage equality,
right.
So that gay folks could get married. And two, secular officiants. Because at this point, if you were gay or if you didn't want a religious wedding, you were being treated unfairly by the state.
I find it really interesting that this kind of flies in the face of the traditional understanding of what Oregon and Washington, like the Pacific Northwest, is supposed to be this liberal bastion, you know, like we're all just wild and crazy and just we all have public transit going through our bathrooms.
Right.
And we clearly don't.
We
live here, and so we know that. But I think the nationally, the expectation is that Oregon and Washington are just, like, on the cutting edge of liberalism. And so the idea that you couldn't get married in Oregon, unless you had a religious celebrant, and if you didn't have a religious celebrant, the government was going to charge you a tax for that.
Right.
Is just really, it's quite strange that it took until now. It's one of those sort of, I don't know, for lack of a better word, I want to call it one of those Mississippi facts. Did you know that Mississippi was the last to legalize, you know, whatever?
Right.
It's always that.
Right.
You know, so it's, or whenever we do the data speed things, and one of the, we always find out that we're behind Albania or some country. And there's
right.
Like, Albania! Can you imagine? Albania!
The fact that our broadband bandwidth kind of stinks.
Right, exactly. But Oregon, one would never think that this was actually an issue in Oregon. I imagine a lot of people might have moved to Oregon thinking that, well, of course, well, now I've moved to Oregon. It's the liberal land of milk and honey.
Right. It's not.
It's absolutely not.
The weird thing about this part of the mm-hmm. world that I have to explain to other people is like, yeah, there are really liberal sections of it. Part one, though, like Chicago people.
Right.
Your public transportation far outstrips what's available here.
Right.
I can get from point A to point B using public transportation in Chicago. Not possible here in the same way. Not,
right.
not even close.
Yeah.
2.5 hours to go 10 miles just because you cross a county line and not after 6 p.m.? Yeah, that's what my daily commute would look like on public transit here.
Right. But that's, you know, I mean, they got started a lot later out here than they
that's
did
true.
In Chicago.
Right.
But the other thing is that we've got this political, you know, this political mountain range
mm-hmm.
Going north and south through both Oregon and Washington.
Right.
And as a result, there, you know, you've got our side of the mountain, which is fairly liberal, not
mm-hmm.
a lot of people
mm-hmm.
Are religious to a certain extent. And then you get on the other side of it, and it's, you know, I mean, the Tri-Cities area reminds me a lot of Phoenix.
Right.
I'll just put it that way as far mm-hmm. as the political outlook. And actually the way it looks and the temperatures, except it actually snows there, which is nice.
But some really neat things is that in the sort of red side of the state, you have these little blue bubbles of immense activity, in the same way that on our blue side of the state, maybe say in rural, more parts of rural Pierce County, you have these red bubbles that are very, you know, vehement and active, bubbling up. And so despite the political mountain range division, you still have a really sort of rich interplay between liberal and progressive politics and more conservative or religious politics.
Right.
And sometimes those don't even go hand in hand. Sometimes the religious and conservative don't meet in the middle, and they don't necessarily,
you know, for example, like educational funding.
Yeah.
Is that, I could feel you circling the drain, so I just decided to hit the drain with the mother of all references. Go on.
I might have some strong feelings about education funding.
Tell us more.
Yeah. There's some sort of decision like the Beverly Cleary decision.
Yes, the Beverly, would that it would be the Beverly Cleary decision.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Yes. The McCleary decision states that we have to amply fund public education in our state. That is the whole reason why the state of Washington was incorporated from a territory to a state. It's in our Constitution. And you'd think that, again, here in the Pacific Northwest, these liberal, progressive bastions of progressive liberalism, right?
With their progressive liberalism and their liberally progressivism.
No, it's in our Constitution to amply fund education for all young people residing within its borders, not just citizens. It literally says young people residing in its borders. And the state legislature can't figure out how to do that without, you know, say, let's cut all social services in order to fund education, because that works.
So I'm going to continue. I got two more points on this one. One is I'm going to continue a very personal conversation that Becky and I have been having, that it has been personal and there's been a lot of tension in it, that I leaked on the 200th episode at Atheist Nomads, and that is my desire for Becky to start an education, not an atheist related, or, you know, nothing to do with atheism, but an education related podcast.
That would be, you know what? Yes. I second the motion.
Because it's not like I have any feelings or experience about education.
No, it's not like you spend all of your time thinking about it.
Right.
And it's not like people seek out your opinion.
One of my favorite podcasts around the middle of Battlestar Galactica had so much Battlestar Galactica content that they just spun off a Battlestar Galactica's podcast. I think this may be that situation where we need to, we need an education podcast in order to save Ask an Atheist from becoming an education podcast.
Oh, dear. Is that the point at which we're at?
I don't think it's necessarily the point at which we're at. I'm making a very glib analogy, but I definitely believe it's a strong passion for you, and I think it's a strong passion for you as well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. You, for those of you on the radio, you can't see me pointing. You can't see me like moving my face. But yeah, to you, Becky, and to you, Sam.
And to you, Ron John.
Yes, it is very much a point of passion for me, but I do see that they're very interrelated to each other, and so it's really easy for them to kind of cross over.
Well, when you have the federal Secretary of Education pushing voucher programs that basically give taxpayer money to religious schools, how you're going to, you know, give non-religious options in the first place, or maintain a secular government when you have in public schools this encroachment of religiosity? That's really a huge overlay and a huge overlap.
In no way do I want to see an end to educational discussions on Ask an Atheist. I actually think that Becky doing an education-related podcast might actually help education-related podcasts or discussions on Ask an Atheist. Because I agree with you. I mean, education and what we talk about here in Ask an Atheist dovetail, like, ridiculously
right. And
so.
We're going to talk a lot more about this in, like, a couple of minutes when we start talking about how fact-based and, you know, being able to ground discussions about policy and whatnot
right.
are driven by the skills that one learns in an educational environment.
One is ostensibly learning in an educational
one
environment.
One ought to be learning in an educational environment.
One that I'm trying to teach. In an educational environment.
Yeah. And so I just decided for reasons that for no reason whatsoever to just out that discussion yesterday.
All right. So I'm on board. Hashtag ask an educationist.
I like it.
Oh my God, you're going to make educationist the new slur for teacher. The private education proponents are going to be slurring us as the educationists.
Right. These activist teachers.
Oh, darn.
Activist teacher would be a pretty good title.
Man, I want that on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
Activist teachers.
Activist teacher, hashtag educationist. Please, someone make it for me.
The other one is coming back to Parallel, because I like the initial implementation of this in Oregon. There was confusion about, or no, there was debate about what constituted an organization that could solemnize marriages, and so they said that holds a parallel. What is precisely
parallel place in the lives of the organization's members to that of a church or other religious authority?
So I think, you know, by trying to come up with a way that says it has to be a religious or a religious-like organization, they missed. Because, honestly, for example, to call back to a conversation we had last week, the Jedi Temple of Tacoma.
It exists.
Continue. I will click on that link later.
Okay.
I'm opening a new tab. Go.
All right. Fine. Fine. So there's a Jedi Temple of Tacoma, and while they may not actually be Jedi, this organization that they belong to and spend a lot of time with holds a similar place in their lives as going to a church might for another individual. So there's no reason why the head of the Jedi Temple of Tacoma shouldn't be able to solemnize marriages under this law.
Right.
And I think that goes for literally any organization where you have people coming together as a community. My Little Pony fans, Model Rocket guys, ham radio people, cooks, fans of Hunky Ghost Hunters.
People that go on conventions together and go camping and any of those things.
Yeah.
Those are all the functions that a church has generally played, aren't they?
Yeah. If it has a central social function in your life.
Right.
If you have a deep emotional attachment to it and it has a central social function in your life, it has a parallel to a church.
So in the back of my head, I'm hearing by the power vested in me by the loyal order of water buffalo. I now pronounce you husband
and
wife. Spouse and spouse.
I now pronounce you married.
Right.
Which is generally the preferred...
I pronounce you buffali.
Buffalopities.
No, I think that you're really onto something here, Sam. That when you say, you know, in an attempt for whoever in Oregon really wants to maintain this church-like structure for solemnizing marriages.
Yeah.
Whoever, you know, had that say, well, we got to make it as narrow as possible. Okay, the organization has to be somewhat church-like. They've basically opened it to anyone who engages in society and in social groupings.
Right.
Based on whatever their particular folk affinity is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
I love it.
Like the Kiwanis, the Trollhagen folks in Ballard. Like, they should absolutely be able to do that.
An art collective.
Right.
Yeah. And I think in Washington, you can. I mean, now the get out for a million years for this has been the Universal Life Church, which is what most people do when they're suddenly... It's how I solemnize marriages.
Right.
Is I'm technically clergy because...
Because a website and $25.
Yeah, because a website and $25.
Actually, you got it pre-website, didn't you? You got it from the back of the catalog.
No, I got it. I got it the week they opened their website. They launched their website in 1996.
Oh, that's a natural fit for Sam.
Yeah. back in, I think it was 96. It was 95 or 96. I was working at Starnet. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, the guy who do the churches at the back of the magazines. He's got a website now. And you can sign up there. I am totally doing this. and I did. And I would just go around Bradley. You know, I think the joke was we just pick two people and marry them.
Right.
You're married now. I forget who started that one.
I unmarified you.
Yeah. And that was the joke. But then, as it turns out, decade or two later, I was in Arizona and I needed to perform marriage for Laura and Dirk.
Right.
And they didn't know, you know, she was a Mormon, he was a pagan, nobody would marry them except an atheist.
Right.
And
together they fight crime.
Yeah. Yeah, actually kind of, yeah. And so they figured I wouldn't care, or that it would be fun. So I did it.
But that's what it comes down to. They figured it would be fun.
Yeah.
Like, it's their choice. They get to make that choice. The fact that there's got to be some third party involved in this, like, why does a third party have to be involved in what two people decide is the right way to get married?
Social control.
Well, yes.
I mean, honestly.
Other than that.
Yeah. It's because it's one of those things that religion took over.
Right.
And
it's still to a certain extent there. If you look at the language, we're still talking about how we solemnize
yeah.
a marriage, as opposed to just how we just, you know, say...
Recognize.
How we recognize it
as
marriage,
we
right?
went from religious government to secular government,
mm-hmm.
we've tried to figure out what things that... And this is part of the experiment of the United States.
Right.
Is figuring out what parts of the government, of a religious government, have no place in a secular government.
Right.
One of the things that we carried over... was a government like a nationalized requirement and understanding of what marriage is.
Right.
And as we continue the experiment of the United States, some experiments work, like marriage equality. Some experiments fail, like a reality star president. that we figure out that really the government doesn't have a huge place in marriage, except where it touches economic things, but the social construct of marriage, the government doesn't have much of a lookout in it.
Right.
Especially as marriage has been less about producing further offspring to contribute to the economy and more about just whatever groups of people value within their community, be it religious or not. I always find it funny that some of the more typically religious states like Texas recognize common law marriage more so than some of the more liberal states. Common law marriage is who cares whether someone solemnized it or not. You've been living together for 7 years, you have 3 kids, great, you're married.
Right. Yeah. And I think common law marriage is one of those artifacts you get when the state interest in something hews a little too closely to a religious government, where we're trying to figure out, like, I think common law marriage is one of those things where the experiment, where there's data coming in that the experiment says this isn't really working out.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's really cool. And this is a good step forward. And,
Hooray Oregon. Hooray CFI Portland. Hooray Secular Coalition for Oregon. Hooray
absolutely.
Kate Brown. Yep.
Yes, absolutely.
This is Ask an Atheist. 844-SKEPTIC. 844-753-7842. We're going to go to a break. And when we come back, going to be... interviewing somebody about, what is this, the Truth Pledge? What is the
Truth Pledge and rational politics and all mm-hmm. sorts of interesting science-based decision-making.
Yeah. I'd like to know what rational politics
facts
are.
Facts in action.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen rational politics. This is going to be interesting.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Dorn.
And we want to ask you an important question. Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio Versus the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Hasn't God We Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster In God We Trust on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an In God We Trust decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists, non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at originalmotto.us.
Welcome back. back. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. That's toll-free nationwide. Joining us now is Dr. Gleb Sapirsky. He's an author, speaker, and professor of history of behavioral sciences at Ohio State University. He co-founded and runs the organization Intentional Insights, a nonprofit aimed at helping leaders use science-based strategies for effective decision-making. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Hey, no problem. So your bio on the Intentional. Your bio on the Intentional Insights page states that you are passionate about helping people think more clearly and advancing global flourishing. What defines global flourishing for you?
So global flourishing for me is helping all people be better off in a whole number of ways in personal life, kind of psychological and personal, physical well-being, then in their careers, having better relationships in their society, in their community, and then helping our society be better off. So making sure that our institutions are not messed up and that we have good discourse, that we have good interactions, that the institutions in which we live shape our decisions to make sure that they are the best decisions for all involved. So that is, for me, a very brief description of global flourishing. We can delve into it deeper, but that's the nutshell version.
You know, I noticed that you also market the services towards helping leaders and organizations and individuals avoid disasters. And you say through science-based decision-making, what kinds of disasters do you see that are caused by eschewing science in the decision-making process?
Well, lots of disasters. I mean, one of the things I do is I do consulting, so paid consulting for companies and corporations. I do speaking on this topic. I'll give an example. So I have done some consulting and coaching for a secular nonprofit, and the secular nonprofit had a number of problems with the board of directors being pushy toward the executive director of the nonprofit, and that has caused the director to be really anxious and upset and frustrated about it. And he wasn't willing to kind of reveal and talk about the stuff that was going on. He was afraid the board would fire him if he revealed it. But once I strongly encouraged him to do it and encouraged him to change his behavior and change his thinking, once he revealed it, the board was very supportive and they were much more tolerant than he thought that they would be. And he was much better able to perform the functions that he needed to perform after he revealed his anxiety. So that's kind of one decision. It's something that could have led to a disaster in terms of him leaving, and the organization would have been really badly off, and he would have not been happy either to have left. That's sort of one disaster that was avoided. Another disaster is, so I'm doing consulting for a corporation that is here in the Columbus area where I'm based. And they have, it's a group of engineers. It's a 200 people company. They have 150 engineers, hard science engineers, welding, stuff like that, who they're trying to motivate to do selling. And when they're trying to motivate them to do selling, the engineers weren't really motivated to do selling. So they gave them training. The engineers weren't doing selling. And they're like, well, what's going on? Are the engineers stupid? Are they incompetent? They brought me in, and what occurred was that the engineers weren't emotionally motivated to actually engage in selling because they weren't speaking to them well. So the company was slowly going out of business, losing customers, losing sales because the engineers weren't doing selling. And I just changed the way that the company spoke to them and not oriented toward, hey, you need to do this for the sake of the company, but saying, hey, if you do this, you will have higher reputation among your peers and higher, you know, thought leadership and reputation. So appealing to their emotions, to their motivations, changed their everyday decision-making in such a way that the company didn't go out of business.
That is an absolutely fascinating way to talk to a community that has a discipline associated with how they make decisions. And I think different communities have different ways of making decisions. They have different rules of evidence and different processes that they use. And those processes, and they tend to become the way that that tribe defines themselves or that group defines themselves as different than other groups. You've given a couple of very specific examples, but I'd like to talk a little bit about what you think causes poor decision-making from a research perspective.
Hmm. So from a research perspective, something that causes poor decision-making is that people are not inherently aware they can be educated and they can learn about making better decisions. So basically, we have our intuitions, our gut reactions that cause us to make decisions one way or another. And people tend to be very comfortable going with their guts, and they think that, well, whatever my intuition tells me, that's what I'm going to do. So whatever I'm comfortable with, that's what I'm going to do. Whereas what the research shows is that the things that we're comfortable with, those are things that have to do with the way that we were brought up, and especially instincts that come from our savanna environment. So our brain evolved for the savanna environment, not necessarily for reality right now.
Okay.
And our current reality now is not very well, is not that much of a savanna environment. You know, so when we see things on television, let's say, and when it's somebody is telling us something that is appealing to our current sense of values, we tend to think of it as true. Whereas in reality, what we are feeling is comfort. And people often tend to mistake truth for comfort. And this is a fundamental, fundamental thing that causes people to make horrible decisions in our political system, in our finances, in their relationships, and so on. When they hear things that are comfortable, they believe those things, as opposed to actually evaluating whether those things are true, because they tend to match their gut intuitions and their sense of, oh, this is my tribe that's telling me this, this is comfortable for me to hear, and they don't question it. So this is a fundamental reason why many, many people make bad decisions. I mean, we talked about corporations. One of the top five reasons why CEOs get fired by boards of directors is that the CEOs are not willing to acknowledge a challenging reality. So not that the CEOs didn't do a good job or bad job, they're not willing to acknowledge the reality that their situation is worse than they're perceiving it to be. So just not acknowledging reality is really bad for people. So this is CEOs at the top level, one of the top five reasons they get fired. That's one. But our politics is even worse. CEOs have a financial motivation to at least not get fired, right? And right. Not acknowledge reality. What kind of motivation do people have to see truth in their political system? Politicians have a motivation to lie. They have every motivation to lie, to deceive people, because that's what helps them get elected. We saw this in this recent election cycle. Oxford Dictionary defined the word of the year for 2016 to be post-truth politics, based on the lies and deceptions that resulted from the Brexit Leave campaign in the UK and the Trump election campaign. So this is, you know, a neutral source, Oxford Dictionary, venerable dictionary, chose post-truth politics as the word of the year because of the lies and deceptions. And the politicians used these to get elected because so many of their followers were very comfortable with lies and deceptions. There are statistics showing that of Republicans, about 88% of people don't trust fact checkers. So that's 88% of Republicans don't trust fact checkers, something like in the high 40s of Democrats don't trust fact checkers, which is bad. But
those are both scarily high numbers. I know 80 feels like it's huge, but 40 is terrible as well.
Substantial.
Yes, it is. It is terrible as well. But I mean, 88%. Well, you see the difference about, you know, why the Republicans were the ones that were attributed to the post-truth politics, not the Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's definitely lies among Democrats, not saying there aren't, but much more among Republicans. That's
right.
Just the case, according to, you know, all neutral fact-checking organizations. And the Republicans don't trust fact-checkers because fact-checkers tell them that, hey, my leaders are lying to me, my tribe members, the leaders of my tribe are lying to me. Am I going to trust my tribe members? Am I going to trust my gut reactions? Or am I going to trust these neutral organizations? So, you know, it's much more comfortable to trust your gut and to trust your leaders than to actually evaluate reality.
So you mentioned something earlier, and I want to kind of I want to follow up on it. And it was about the savanna thinking, that basically what you're describing are sort of like cognitive bugs that are kind of like a holdover from the previous environment that we had to learn to survive in and evolve to survive in, that now no longer really serve us when it comes to evaluating truth, evaluating facts, just evaluating statements in general to determine whether or not they carry value as facts, or do they merely carry value as a source of comfort. What's the fix? What's the patch? Like, how do we address or even mitigate those kinds of bugs in how we process media or anything?
So this is a really important question. Those bugs were survival mechanisms in the savanna environment. From the perspective of what the recent research shows us, arguments and rhetoric were not essentially mechanisms at heart to discover the truth. They were mechanisms to make sure that the tribe follows your perspective. And various biases, they're called cognitive biases. So cognitive bugs, the scientific name for them is cognitive bias. Folks can look them up. There's over 100 of them on the Wikipedia list of cognitive biases.
Some of which are real.
Right. It's Wikipedia. How could it possibly not be true?
I mean, as a professor, I don't recommend Wikipedia often. The people who are working on it are good folks who are graduate students, scholars. So they're actually, the list of cognitive biases is real and quite good. There's one of the fundamental ones is confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is basically where we tend to interpret new information in accordance with our ideological blinkers unless we deliberately make an effort not to. So our natural intuitive reactions in the tribal environment, this was the safety mechanism. It was safer to survive that way, to go along with our tribe than to see reality. We are the people whose ancestors were the ones who preferred to not see reality for the sake of going along with the tribe, because those are the people who survived.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not very functional in the current environment. Not good mm-hmm. for our society. Good for being in a tribal sense, like, you know, reality didn't matter that much. You know, oh, hey, let me believe what the shaman is saying rather than, like, complain and get kicked out of the tribe and beaten by the wolves, right? So that was a healthy attitude to survive back then. Today, that's causing post-truth politicians to take advantage of us and manipulate and get elected in a way that really harms our society in the long run. So the fix to that is to take specific, deliberate steps to create a community of people who you know are going to be oriented toward the truth. And this is what we're doing at Intentional Insights, especially with the Pro-Truth Pledge at protruthpledge.org. For listeners who want to follow along with the conversation here, they can go to protruthpledge.org and check it out. The function of that is to reverse the tide of lies in our society in the US and around the globe by creating a community of people who are oriented toward the truth, who we know are oriented toward the truth, and change the incentives for politicians and other public figures to tell the truth as opposed to lying. Right now, they have incentives to lie, and this would change their incentives to tell the truth.
So when we talk about behaviors that we have as a group that derive from our beginnings on the savannas in Africa, if not exactly evolutionary psychology, it seems to be at least within the orbit of evolutionary psychology. Is that a fair assessment, or am I completely off base?
No, you're absolutely right. It is coming definitely from the evolutionary environment, and where there are things in the evolutionary environment that served us well, like the confirmation bias. Remember, the evolutionary environment, so interesting experiment. There have been a number of studies showing that games that are played by theoretical agents, where you pit agents who are oriented toward winning and surviving versus agents who are oriented toward toward accurate evaluation of reality, the ones who are oriented toward surviving and winning are the ones who will win. So it basically, unless you tilt the floor, the people who are oriented toward lying will win.
Right.
And that's just the nature of the game. And this is the nature of reality. This game is reality. You know, in our reality, people aren't rewarded for telling the truth. They're rewarded for winning, which includes lying. Because, you know, to win, often lying is a good strategy. So if you want to survive in the savannah, lying is a good strategy. Believing in falsehoods is a good strategy for surviving. Not so much in the current environment, because that screws up our whole society and causes really negative long-term consequences. So we've had a lot of democracies that went into corruption and authoritarianism because of lying. We have Turkey going into that now. We had Russia go into that about a decade ago.
Yeah.
transitioned from a democracy to an authoritarian state. We had Spain, Portugal, Italy, Germany go through that. We had a number of other democracies go into that, from a democracy into an authoritarian state. There's no reason that the United States will not follow it if we keep favoring and encouraging lying instead of telling the truth. And this is what I am trying to do and what the organization that I am helping lead is trying to do. Change the incentives for people using the latest research in behavioral science about how you effectively incentivize people to tell the truth as opposed to lie.
You know, it's a very ominous prediction that you make here if we're not able to combat this. Related to cognitive bias and confirmation bias that you mentioned is this backfire effect. You know, it's a known phenomenon that individuals will rationalize their beliefs, even if they're incomplete, even when faced with that contrary evidence, regardless of reality. So how do those of us that value rational thinking combat this, especially in light of this this forward movement towards perhaps transitioning from democracy to an authoritarian reality?
So I actually wrote an article about this very topic in Scientific American. It was published a couple of days ago. It's called Sometimes Facts Can Actually Trump Ideology, and folks who are curious can look it up. It goes into it in detail about how I go on conservative radio shows and talk to people, conservative radio show hosts, in ways that get them to change their minds.
Please tell us the secrets right now.
Right. What are the magic words?
Sure. I'll give an example with Scott Sloan, who's well-known in the atheist and secular community as a conservative Christian. He debated with Aaron Ra on the ark that was built in Kentucky, the evolutionary park, or the park that was devoted to creationism. So I talked to him about Muslims and terrorism after a terrorist attack here at Ohio State. And after the terrorist attack, I went on his show, and as you can imagine, Scott Sloan was not very nice toward Muslims. You know, persecute them, whatever, harshly, all that regular stuff. So I first started with validating his emotions, and this is the first tactic. Don't tell people that their emotions are wrong. You need to start with their emotions. The backfire effect occurs because people are feeling defensive or aggressive. So what you want to do is minimize the possibility that people go into a defensive or aggressive state by validating their emotions. By validating their emotions, I mean saying that their emotions are fine, real, and not wrong. So what I told Scott was like, hey, you know, I totally get why you would be angry toward Muslims and afraid of Muslims. I can hear you, and I can feel that. You know, I feel fear and anger toward Muslims. Regardless, I only felt very little fear and anger toward Muslims, but, you know, you validate his emotions, and you bond. You create that bond. We both feel fear and anger toward Muslims. But what do we both want? We both want safety and security. That's our priority. Now, safety and security, you know, there's a lot of research that that's what conservatives want, so I was pretty sure that's what he wanted. We both want safety and security. So let's talk about how we get safety and security, Scott. Well, if we persecute Muslims, let's think about what happens. In 2015, so this attack happened in 2016. In 2015, there were 6 Muslim terrorists and attacks in the U.S., and there were something like 1.8 million adult Muslims in the U.S. Now, so your rate of finding a Muslim committing a terrorist attack is, you know, 1 out of 300,000 per year. So not very good odds, Scott. You're going to get a lot of false positives. You're going to waste your resources of safety and security on those people.
Right.
Now, you have only limited resources, so you'll let the actual terrorists slip by if you focus on Muslims. That's one. Second, the FBI had said that it got really great cooperation from Muslim communities pointing out potential terrorists in their midst and preventing terrorist attacks. If you start persecuting Muslim communities, they're not really going to want to cooperate anymore with you.
So even more false positives, yeah. And even more misses.
Even more misses and less security.
Right.
And finally, we already have Al-Shabaab and other terrorist organizations using Donald Trump's anti-Muslim rhetoric to recruit American terrorists. You're going to have even more of that if you have persecution of Muslims here in the United States. So for the sake of safety and security, even if we don't feel like it, even if we feel fearful and angry toward Muslims, we should be nice and generous to them just for the sake of our safety and security.
This is
Here's where...
Yeah, this is the mechanism of precisely what you're talking about, which is It's comforting to take a hardline stance on a group of people that you believe is the source of something that attacks your security. But instead of putting something in place that interfaces with this group of people and creates a more secure environment for everybody, instead we do something which we call in information security, security theater, is we make a bunch of, we basically lie and we do a bunch of stuff that looks hardline, but accomplishes very little, thus decreasing security overall. And that's that sounds like the mechanism of sort of the biases that lead us down dangerous paths in, you know, in policy. Now, what is, we've talked about the pro-truth pledge a little bit, you've already plugged it. What's the functional mechanism of the pro-truth pledge? In other words, what is it?
Sure. So again, folks can go to pro-truth pledge at protruthpledge.org so that they can follow along with what the mechanism is. Now, the pro-truth pledge is getting people to commit to 13 behaviors. It's not telling you what the truth is. It's saying, here are 13 behaviors that are shown by research in behavioral science, and that was composed by a team of behavioral scientists, including me and others, that research shows are aligned with the truth. For example, one of the behaviors is, I will strive to avoid sharing misinformation, even in service to a cause I believe is good. Another one is, if my information is challenged, I will make a reasonable effort to verify that it is true before repeating it and retract it if I cannot verify it. Another one is, I will gladly celebrate those who retract incorrect statements and update their beliefs toward the truth. And there are 10 more. So this is 13 behaviors that people, you know, that research shows have aligned with the truth. Now, for people who take the pledge, then folks who are following along can click on Take the Pledge, the orange button there. There's a chance to give their emails and names. Those are obligatory. Then phone, and you can provide your home address. The goal of that is so that we can tell people this pledge, one of its functions, is to function as a petition. People can click or leave, click the button that says, I call on all of my elected representatives to take the pro-truth pledge. So then people who are volunteers for the pro-truth pledge can go to all of your elected representatives from your official district judge or something like that at your local county level, to your mayor, to your state senator, to your congressperson, to your actual senator, and all the way to the president and say, hey, you have these constituents who want you to take the pro-truth pledge. Can you take it? Then you can be listed in the public database of people who signed the pro-truth pledge. That helps you join the community of people who are pro-truth pledge advocates, and you can know that you can rely on those people to be oriented toward the truth much more than you can on any regular person. So you can have a community of people. There's a database, there's emails that go out to people. You can sign up to emails. You can also sign up to action alerts, which I'll describe in just a bit. And you can sign up to help with the pro-truth pledge, which means doing things like public outreach, lobbying officials, doing donations, definitely important to have financial donations, evaluating and monitoring politicians and other public figures who took the pro-truth pledge, and so on. And so that's one aspect. That's for ordinary citizens. Then there's an aspect for public figures. Public figures, that's anyone who has an impact on the public sphere. Everyone from the president to the district judge to reporters to podcast hosts like the three of you, to myself, like, you know, a public figure who goes on podcasts and comments on things, analysts and commentators. Now, this provides them with incentives. It changes their incentives. Provides them with rewards for telling the truth. They have a chance to click on I'm a public figure, and then they have a chance to give a paragraph about why they chose to take the pro-truth pledge, and to give a link to their social media. So, for example, if you're a politician, you can give a link to your website, you can give a link to your campaign page, you can give a link to your Facebook. If you're a podcast host, like the three of you, you can give a link to your podcast and your Patreon page if you have one, and so on. And for people, so that way, you get traffic from people, you get supporters. If you're a politician, then you get traffic and listeners from people who signed up to the pro-truth pledge, who care about the truth. Now, are they going to listen to a podcast that cares about the truth, or, you know, a podcast that doesn't care about the truth because they haven't signed the pro-truth pledge? Of course they'll listen to a podcast that cares about the truth. And who are they going to support as a politician, one who cares about the truth or one who doesn't care about the truth? So that's the big incentive. And there's also punishing penalty for people who don't follow along with the pro-truth pledge. But that's kind of the rewards and the incentives for people to do so.
So I read about this a few weeks ago, and I thought it was a great idea. And in the atheism community, I can imagine that this would be a fertile ground for looking for people and establishing a concept of, you know, rational and evidence-based policymaking. How do you perceive sort of promoting this to areas outside of the atheism community where the idea of evidence-based policy is, you know, while it sounds nice, it doesn't have as much currency? For example, the Republican Party, where 80% of the people don't like fact-checkers, or the Democratic Party, where 40% of the people don't like fact-checkers.
A mere 40%.
A mere 40%, yeah.
A mere 40%, yes.
How do you perceive, because unfortunately, we live in an era where we kind of have to market this kind of stuff. How do you see moving forward on that?
I mean, we've had quite a lot of success. So, for example, I'll give you some examples of success stories. If any of you folks knows what the Rotary Club is, and I'll describe it to listeners, it's a service organization that's composed of people who are business professionals who tend to leave conservative, tend to lean Republican. They often have Republican senators presenting and Congress people presenting to them. So we had a person from our organization, Susan Lear, go and present to a Rotary Club here in Hilliard, which is in the suburb of Columbus, and the suburb itself tends to lean very red Republican. So she went, presented to 20 people about the pro-truth pledge and said, hey, you know, don't you want your politicians to be telling the truth? Don't you want, you know, yourself to be telling the truth? Don't you want to create incentives for people to be telling the truth? And they were like, yes, this is a good thing. Let's create incentives for politicians and everyone to tell the truth. Let's, you know, sign the pledge. And out of 20 people, she got five people to sign the pledge. That's a 25% return rate. That's great.
That is good.
Now we go, yeah. So I went on conservative radio shows and got people to sign the pro-truth pledge because they're like, yes, I want the truth. Definitely. And I want people to fact check me who are not fact check. You know, I want to make sure that, you know, I am fact check as well and I tell the truth. So they want to be known as people who are telling the truth. Now, there is definitely within the Republican Party, as well as the Democratic Party, there is a sizable number of people. Not sure if it's a majority or not. You know, in Hillary Clinton's famous line, you know, the half of Trump supporters are deplorables. I have no idea where that actually lies. If we say that, you know, quote-unquote deplorables are people who prefer lies, who consciously prefer lies, and there are a number of people who say this. There are a number of people among Republicans, who say, I don't care what the truth is. My mind is made up. Don't give me your facts.
Right.
And there are a number of people who say this. And they are not the people who will sign the pro-truth pledge.
Right.
And that's fine. But there is a whole number of people who say, I care about what the truth is. Yes, let's go and figure out the truth. Now, research shows that a number of Republicans are simply mistaken about what the truth is. They might think they know the truth, but they're simply mistaken. So, for example, among Republicans, the latest polls suggest, you know, a poll taken on May 10th and 11th, so it's not the latest poll, I haven't seen the latest polls, suggests that only 24% that believe that Comey's firing had anything to do with the Russia investigation. 24% out of all Republicans believe that. Most of Republicans believe that Donald Trump won the popular vote. So people are simply, I mean, most Republicans believe that the economy went down under Obama and the stock market went down under Obama. They're simply mistaken about the facts of reality. So it's not kind of a malicious thing. They're not saying, I don't want to know the truth. They're just mistaken about what the truth is. There's a whole bunch of people who are reachable, And we've had success. We are having success with reaching out to them. We have Republicans, Republican politicians who signed the pro-truth pledge, as well as Democratic politicians who signed the pro-truth pledge. We had conservative radio show hosts and business people sign the pro-truth pledge, like I said, as well as liberal ones signing the pro-truth pledge. There are plenty of people who are oriented toward the truth and who want the truth that cuts across partisan lines.
You know, in terms of cutting across partisan lines, I got to admit, when I first saw something called the pro-truth pledge, I had an initial reaction to the word pledge. Many rationalists who are often nonconformists, you know, kind of prickle at that word pledge. Yeah. We have, you know, the connotation of unthinking devotion. We have pledge of allegiance that is somewhat maligned amongst secularists who don't like under God in it and things like that. Was there an intentional effort to call this movement a pro-truth pledge to sort of target the huge reachable swath of, you know, polled Republicans that are maybe mistaken about this?
Mm-hmm. There was a sense of commitment because there are a number of pledges that politicians and especially Republicans are asked to take. And so pledge is a word, just like the word truth is a word that resonates with a number of people across the partisan lines, especially Republicans, so is pledge. Both of these things are resonate. So we created these with some target group focus group research on what words would resonate. You know, ideally, if we were doing this in a scientific manner, this would be a pro-facts and rational thinking commitment mm-hmm. to, you know, commitment to facts and rational thinking or something like that.
Mm-hmm. That might not resonate as much with the Rotary Club.
Yes, exactly. You know, it's not something that would resonate with the Rotary Club. Whereas something like, you know, and the word pro is also, you know, you have pro-life, right?
Right.
So you have pro and truth is a word. Pro is something that, you know, good. Hey, we were thinking in the early version about like an anti-lies pledge. But we're like, no, we need to make it. We talked to a number of politicians and it was like, no, we need to make this a pro something. So pro for something that, you know, cuts across partisan lines is a good thing. Truth, and then a sense of commitment that is in line with other types of commitment that people make, pledge.
I have to admit, when I first heard about it and I heard it called the pro-truth pledge, there's a little bit of cognitive dissonance in my head because it was called the pro-truth pledge. And I don't think that, while I like to be fact-based and I like to be evidence-based, I tend to think of truth as, like, the idea of truth as a religious context, concept mm-hmm. or something like that. So, you know, that the way you've described it, I think, you know, I had to think about it. It's like, no, this needs to be marketed to people who don't know what who wouldn't feel the same way as I would. So thank you for addressing that directly.
So
you're welcome. It's very much intended for that. And it's intended, you know, we anticipate that the early adopters will be people who don't need it.
They're already in the boat, if you will.
Yes, they're right. Already in the boat, and they will go out to people. Like we have Susan Lear, right, who went to this Rotary Club. She doesn't need this pro-truth pledge. She's like, yes, I already support this. But then she will go to her Rotary Club, not her Rotary Club, she's not a member, but she will go to the Rotary Club and do a presentation, and she will get, you know, 25% of the people to sign up.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. So right now, what we're focused on, why I'm going on secular, reason-oriented podcasts, is to get those early adopters, to get the people who will be trustworthy, who will really care about this, who will want to sign up and be volunteers, as well as just advocates and share about it in social media, and who will get some of their people in their social network who are not already signed up to sign up. So kind of creating a network effect.
I love hearing about the activism and the sort of proactive the activities that your team and you have been taking on to reach directly out to people who have contrary opinions, who contrary opinions is actually maybe a phrase that we kind of want to step away from, and we want to simply say that they endanger the truth by mm-hmm. speaking as if there are alternative facts. This phrase that's become yes. that's come into popular devastating usage. I wanted to touch on a different aspect of this, which is we've been talking a lot about people and their alignment with the truth. I think you make a really interesting point in the guiding document for the Rational Politics Project that I kind of wanted to call out and talk a little bit about, which is the idea of truth as a standing thing. It doesn't have to mm-hmm. be, in the words of Neil deGrasse Tyson, that science isn't something, science is true whether you believe it or not.
Right.
It's actually there. It doesn't require action to be fed. It's mm-hmm. it is there. And if I may, I'd like to quote from the guiding document. You say, like clean air and water, truth is a public common good. Pollution of the truth will devastate all of us in a tragedy of the commons. Yet very few of us are individually motivated to clean it up. I find the I find that idea of treating it like a common good, like a like kind of, you know, in a similar way to clean air and clean water. I find that fascinating, that it's a terrain. It's separate from us. And that it's our obligation to maintain it for others, as opposed to us being oriented in some way, like the truth is in us. It's not. It's a separate thing.
It is. It is outside of us, just like clean air and water is outside of us. And some people are naturally, intuitively care about clean air and water. Most of us don't have that intuitive caring until the environmental movement identified this idea and created this idea that we should care about clean air and water. So we've actually been studying the environmental movement and how it succeeded in persuading people that clean air and water is a thing that we should protect. So we are using some of the same tactics, their most successful tactics of the environmental movement, to address the pollution of truth, because the truth is out there, and polluting it really harms us all in the long run, just like pollution of clean air and water devastates our physical environment. Pollution of truth devastates our public discourse, our civic environment. People around us are all devastated by pollution of the truth. But no one is individually motivated to address it, to clean it up. So the Pro-Truth Pledge combines a number of the best efforts of the environmental movement to change the dynamics and the incentives for people to be oriented toward the truth. There are a number of things that it does. It creates information about who is truth-oriented, which is kind of like the green, who is green, and so on, and creates an identity, a community of people who are truth-oriented, just like the environmentalist movement. So the pro-truth movement is an identity of people, and there is a mechanism by which people all unite, which is the Pro-Truth Pledge. You go there on protruthpledge.org, and you sign up to the pledge, and you have an opportunity to become a volunteer for the movement in various ways. And, you know, buy the shirt or something like that. And so there's a whole variety of ways that this resembles the early start of the environmental movement, but in a much more conscious way. You know, there are lots of things that the early environmentalists did that didn't pan out and that we don't hear about because they didn't pan out.
Right.
So we're looking at what were the best things that worked from it and trying to adapt it and take it forward that way.
That is, it's interesting to hear the connection between the pro-truth movement that you're trying to build and the environmental movement that we now live with, like it is actually a thing that has always been there. And it's good to recognize that it's a thing that was built. It's a thing that it started out as an intention. It started out as a handful of people really kind of speaking up about this, very small communities, and it eventually became not only a movement, but there's a corresponding industry. There's an entire community of people who dedicate their lives to this, and they don't dedicate their lives in some sort of like monk-like practice. It's actually a job. It's a career. Yes. One of the things that I did want to touch on regarding that group of people. So now that we've been talking a lot about people themselves and their orientation to the truth, I know that in the environmental movement there have been sort of cultural slaps in the face. There have been moments, and I think the Trump election and Brexit and a lot of the political stuff that's happening right now kind of represents a slap in the face to those who find themselves wanting to be aligned to the truth. How do you maintain motivation in these times? Like these are, and it's interesting. I find myself using some of the language that I hear from conservative talk radio. But these are, you know, this is a time of truth and exile, if I may. We're standing.
Really?
We're in a radio studio. How am I not going to make the reference?
Oh.
But we live in a challenging time to be oriented towards the truth. When weaponizing rhetoric feels like it could be more effective.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we stay motivated and aligned when the stakes are so high?
I think the important thing, it's funny, I was asked this question in the form of, you know, where were you 20 years ago when this was really, you know, when this was all getting started, or, you know, 10 years ago. And, you know, we just have to realize that the environmental movement came along in the 1970s by accident. What would have happened if it came along in the 1980s? How much worse off would we be? Or the 1990s? How much worse off would we be? You know, we have to start where we are right now and not in an ideal world. Right now, we are where we are. And the truth is under deep attack, under fundamental attack. And we are definitely in danger of an authoritarian state here in the United States, but that's somewhat incidental. Not somewhat, it's a bad thing. It's a horrible thing. But we are really we really care about this from a global perspective as well. We have activists in a number of countries, around 30 countries around the globe, in democracies who are trying to, you know, in Netherlands, in the UK, and elsewhere, who are trying to establish pro-truth oriented communities there as well, because they cross party lines and so on. So we can do this. So we are where we are right now, and we have to realize that we can't, we will in the future face more attacks on the truth from Trump or from other politicians. The danger, the huge danger of Trump is not so much Trump himself. You know, a lot of people are saying, oh, we'll just get rid of Trump, it'll be great, we'll impeach Trump, and that's all. Right. No, Trump showed what's possible. He showed these tactics and strategies. Future politicians, current politicians, are already adapting these tactics to their arsenal. And this is not only Republicans. This is Democrats and Republicans alike. There are so many, I mean, I can go on and like in great depth about specific strategies adopted by specific politicians that are Trump-like.
Well, do you find then, looking globally, that you and your colleagues are somewhat buoyed by the defeats of people like Le Pen or in France, or the recent election in the Netherlands, where we didn't have a post-truth politician and someone that aligned more with with authoritarian rhetoric elected?
More of a triumph of it was that there was less of an alignment of the electorate to fear and more of an alignment to, well, the
combating fear?
Right, to combating it.
It was definitely a relief, yes. I would agree that it was a relief, and I'm happy that it happened, but I'm really concerned about the future, because this is more the institutional perspective. You know, just because of individual elections don't change underlying institutions, don't change underlying dynamics.
Right.
The underlying dynamics with social media and fake news, the various bots that are created by Russia and so on. There is a whole industry that is right now being paid to manipulate elections around the world. And this is not simply Russia is just one player in this, it's a huge player. There's a whole huge industry that is being created in order to manipulate elections in the direction of certain policies that are really harmful, and I'm really worried about the future. So whatever we can do to address this is it's fundamental that we do it right now, and we do it as quickly and as intensely as we can, because otherwise truth is not incentivized. We are not incentivizing the truth. We're right now incentivizing lies in our society. It will keep going forward. Individual elections, while they matter, they don't change the underlying dynamics. What the pro-truth pledge is aimed to do is change the dynamics, change the underlying dynamics, change the rewards for politicians and other public figures to orient toward the truth instead of lies. And it's systematic. People, we over-focus too much on individuals, and we don't focus nearly enough on systems. Systems are the key. Systems are the key. Trump is not the key. You know, Le Pen is not the key. Systems are the key. The dynamics are the key. We need to change the institutions. We need to change the structure. The pro-truth pledge is what changes the structure. This is what behavioral science at heart is about. How do you change the structure so that we are, as human beings who are manipulatable, are defaulting toward telling the truth instead of lying?
So if I wanted this interview to be a complete success, I would wrap it up right here, because that's a great end. Mm-hmm. However, I have this thing clawing at my brain that means nothing and has no importance whatsoever, but I have to ask it, so I'm going to get it out of my brain. I totally understand the post-truth marketing in this. When we talk about the post-truth is the new word of the year, that we discuss Brexit and the rise of Trump as post-truth politics, and the way some journalism is happening, especially online, as post-truth journalism, and we describe it as post-truth. Yeah. That suggests that we had a pre-truth and a truth era. When were those eras?
So, to be clear, the post-truth politics is described by Oxford Dictionary as a political environment in which appeals to lies and personal belief are more influential than appeals to facts. In the past, appeals to facts still overcame appeals to lies and deceptions. where, I mean, people lie, no question there. They lied, and you know, people deceived. But when they were caught out, they backed away from those lies. So direct appeals to lies, to deceptions, didn't overcome the truth in cases where the truth was known. Here, in the post-truth era, appeals to lies, to deceptions, very clear lies, very clear deceptions, which were called out in Brexit, in the, you know, here in the U.S. campaign, a lot of lies. In Turkey, in Russia, and in other democracies, these are situations where lies, clear, very obvious lies, where, you know, people who look at them from any external perspective can identify that these are lies, win out over truth. That's what post-truth politics means.
I don't know that I can totally go along with that, with my understanding of how, you know, it, especially journalism and fact collecting has worked in the, like, 19th and 20th centuries in the United States. Like, were I to think about it, I think the fact that we have to now directly appeal to lies and directly instead of just demanding that lies be truth, instead directly appeal to lies, I think is an artifact of the fact that we live in one of the most information-soaked environments that has ever existed in the human race. We have access to facts now. And so instead of talking about it in terms of this is what we knew at the time, it turns out the evidence was wrong. Mm-hmm. But now we can actually, with the click of a button using these horribly fast computers that we have in our pockets at all times, we have access to real data at all times. Mm-hmm. So thinking of it in terms of I actually kind of think of it more as the pre-fact era. Like, eventually, mm-hmm. we'll figure out how all this newfangled technology works, and then we'll be able to make better appeals to truth than we've ever made before. I mean, this is a source of optimism for me. And so to call it the post-fact era brings a pessimism that I'm a little bit incompatible with.
I hear you, and I appreciate your optimism, but...
We hear you appealing to his emotions. No, see, we learned from you.
See, you shared your toolkit,
yes,
and now all the secrets are out.
Good, I hear you. I appreciate your optimism. I totally do. But if we look back to what happened in 2015, mm-hmm. we had the same amount of information. In 2014, we had the same amount of information. 2013, we had the same amount of information. But if you look at the polls for 2015... the Gallup poll for 2015 to 2016, comparing trust in fact checkers and media among Republicans, you'll see that it fell by more than half.
Wow.
Absolutely.
No change in information availability. Same fact checking websites. You know, I mean, PolitiFact rated Obama's like, you know, oh, you can keep your healthcare plan as the lie of the year in 2013. This is not politicized. This is kind of, you know, a difference between 1 year. From 2015 to 2016, a fall by more than, and the Republican, let me be clear, it wasn't that this was changing. Republican trust in fact-checking and mainstream media remained relatively stable from 2005 to 2015.
Right.
From 2015 to 2016, it fell by more than half.
Wait, the lie of the year in 2013 was you can keep your health care?
Yes.
The lie of the year of 2013 should have been, honest, we're Ukrainians.
Whatever. This is what shows as the lie of the year. I'm not responsible for
right.
political.
No, yeah, obviously. But
so for 20, so I'm telling you, like, this is not a matter of technology. This is a matter of culture. This is a matter of a radical, strong departure in our culture, where from 2005 to 2015, we had pretty stable Republican kind of, you know, trust in mainstream media fall by more than half from 2015 to 2016. This is huge. This is something really different. And we need to understand that it's something really different.
I totally acknowledge that it's mutated into something different, but it's just in my experience, this the whole reason why, if you go to somebody who thinks of a fact checker and they go, well, who's a fact checker? It's somebody who checks facts. They're probably going to agree with it. But it started in 2014 or 2015. Actually, no. I'm sorry. In 2012, mm-hmm. there was it. That's when the actual war against fact checking started within the Republican Party, where people would start saying that fact checkers don't actually check facts,
or they're biased,
or they're biased.
Right.
And so, I mean, that's part of where my optimism comes from, is that this distrust of media. I mean, we've been hearing about the distrust of mainstream media for going on. I mean, I've been hearing it since I was in high school.
Right.
From that particular from
conservative talk radio,
right. Especially from conservative talk radio.
But it's not a recent phenomenon to package and then deploy,
right?
The notion of the mainstream media as a biased information source,
right?
That's been around for a long time.
This just feels like rather than a new phenomenon, this just feels like a mutation of a pre-existing phenomenon.
You certainly had criticism of the mainstream media by Republicans, and more so than Democrats. He actually had it start with Nixon,
right?
And Nixon's anti-media campaign. But it's the question of where it comes into the mainstream and impacts the mainstream in a deep way. That's why Oxford Dictionary chose post-truth politics as the word of the 2016, for its word of 2016, because it impacted mainstream politics in a deep and very scientifically verifiable way. I mean, you can't really argue with numbers. You know, a fall in trust among Republicans by more than half from 2015 to 2016, whereas it stayed stable from 2005 to 2015, including when they started, you know, Republican criticism of fact checkers in 2012. You know, you can tell me your gut intuitions and I can come back with the numbers. You know, what are you going to trust? You know, are you going to trust your gut, or are you going to trust the scientific numbers on this one? So you have stability, and then you have a sharp drop because of, the campaign tactics that were used very effectively to appeal to people and manipulate people. And people, as a result, had very unfortunate perspectives of what reality is, fundamentally flawed ones. So that's what post-truth politics is about. And it's very unfortunate that we're in the situation, and now that Trump mainstreamed it and the Brexit Leave campaign mainstreamed it, they took it out of its small corner of, you know, Tea Party birthers, kind of, you know, that birtherism, that sort of corner, into the mainstream. That's where it's had a huge impact. And it will continue because it's been proven successful. Whoever Trump's successor will be, you know, they will use some of the tactics that he used, and they will likely win because they will use the same tactics that he used. This is why it's so important to build a post-truth movement, to build a post-truth world. In the 1970s, when the environmental movement was starting, they were starting from a perspective understanding that as they were building the environmental movement, the environment would get worse. No question about it. No question about it, because they weren't going to be strong enough to change anything at first. At first, they wouldn't be strong enough. As they went to the Rotary clubs and as they told people about, you know, hey, isn't clean air nice? Don't you want to breathe? You know, they're like, oh, okay, you know, somebody, they would get like the ball rolling. But in order for that snowball to turn into an avalanche, it takes time. It takes effort. And the environment will get worse. Both the environment, the physical environment, the clean air and water, and the environment of truth in our society. It's going to get worse before it gets better, folks. And the only thing we can do is build a movement, a small committed movement of people, to make sure that it gets better as opposed to keep getting worse.
You know, we didn't even get into Soviet fun, which is a book I really wanted to talk about. But this went a little bit over long, but I think we'll have to wrap it up here. So we talked about where to find the Post-Truth Pledge. If people want to follow up and see what you're up to, where would I send them?
So they can go to intentionalinsights.org. That's intentionalinsights.org. That's a nonprofit that runs the Pro-Truth Pledge and focuses on promoting truth in politics and other areas of life. So other areas of life that we talked about. If they're interested in my consulting and coaching and speaking, they can go to my website, which is disasteravoidanceexpert.com. Again, that's disasteravoidanceexpert.com. And to email me, they can always email me at Gleb, GLEB, @intentionalinsights.org.
Lepsperski is an author, speaker, and professor of the history of behavioral sciences at Ohio State University. He co-founded and runs the organization Intentional Insights, a nonprofit aimed at helping leaders use science-based strategies for effective decision-making. This has been an enlightening...
Before we finish,
this has been amazing.
Before we finish, I want to check whether the three of you will take the pro truth pledge as public figures.
I think as a public figure in the realm of education myself and as a podcaster, I am very committed to the 13 principles of the Pro-Truth Pledge.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, it shouldn't be a problem for me.
Excellent. Make sure to give a paragraph about why you took the pledge and give a link to your public information so that more folks can listen to your podcast and other podcasts that aren't truth oriented.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. Like I said, it's been a very enlightening conversation. I would like to talk about your book at some point because it's an interesting book.
Happy to do so.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We're going to go into the break. When we come back, we'll be talking about the best words. We're going to talk about best words, but there is so much going on this week, so much information that we need to understand that it's going to happen in the next episode, which you're going to hear in 2 days. Our voicemail number is 844-753-7842. We're on Facebook. You can email us at questions@askanatheist.tv. You can Twitter us at askanatheistwa. You're going to hear all about this tomorrow or Wednesday. But anyway, it's going to be a fun show. Please stick around. It's going to be a lot of fun.